Genesis chapter 11, Genesis chapter 11, and we will skip through some passages in the book of Genesis as we look at the life of Lot, a wearied Christian. And the title of my message tonight is "The World Wearies the Weak Christian." And I think we all are, at some point, as believers, wearied of the world. We're tired of the vice and the sin and the heartache, and it seems like the news is full of just unbridled sin at times. And we become weary of the world, and I think that should be a part of every believer to some degree. We long for the day of that golden daybreak and entering into heaven's glory, as was sung about tonight. I think that we all have that weariness in our own flesh because we're tired of fighting the sins that so easily beset us. We are often in the same boat as Paul in Romans, and thinking kind of the same way, and the good that I want to do, I don't find myself doing. And so I think there's a weariness in the Christian life of the fact that I just can't, even when I have victory, I don't have it as often or as long as I want, or even when there is a sin that's overcome, it's like there's something else that's just right there. And it's just that weariness even of the flesh. But then there is a weariness in the world that comes because we allow the world to set our priorities. We allow the world to define our standards. We allow the world to affect us and conform us, as Romans 12 and verse 2 would say, conform us into its mold. We're not to be conformed to this world, but we're to be transformed. But there is, in this opening book of the Bible, there is this example of Lot, and I know we've probably heard multiple sermons, but reading through these passages again recently, I couldn't help but get away from the fact that Lot resembles too often too many believers. And the world wearies the weak Christian, burdens the weak Christian with baggage and guilt and consequences that God never intended for the Christian to have. God called us to have a life that is abundant and fruitful, not to live a life of defeat and bondage to sin. Paul even said, "How then can I how can I continue in sin?" He's saying, "How can I have any kind of victory? How can I have any kind of peace, any kind of joy, if I live in the sin that God saved me out of?" And we are looking at a man tonight by the name of Lot, who left Ur and Haran in Mesopotamia, but it was as if Ur and Haran never completely left Lot. And as we start the message tonight, we'll look in Genesis 11 in verse 27. "Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran begat Lot." So this is Abraham's nephew. "And Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah." And then we read down in verse 31, "And Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife. And they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. And they came unto Haran and dwelt there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran." God had called Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees to go to the land of Canaan. And we see in chapter 12, in verse 1, "Now the Lord had said unto Abram," they left Ur of the Chaldees, and they went as far north as Haran, but then they stopped there, and there we read that Terah died. But then we read in verse 5, and Abram took, Genesis 12, verse 5, and Abram took Sarai his wife and Lot his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran. And they went forth to go into the land of Canaan, and into the land of Canaan they came. In a few minutes, we'll put up a map, and we'll see the distance that they traveled. But I just wanted to give a little bit of a background here. This man, Lot, went with Abraham out of this wicked, pagan, idolatrous land. He was in the traveling company, and most of his life he was within at least short distance of one of the most righteous men who ever walked on this earth. Abraham, who became the father of Israel, the father of the Jews, and in whose nation, in whose lineage all the world would be blessed. Lot had a tremendous opportunity. He left Ur of the Chaldees. He left Haran. He was with Abraham. He was right there with a man blessed by God in mighty ways. But what happened to Lot? So close to God and yet so far away. A righteous man, yes, the Bible speaks of him as being just, of being righteous. He was a saved man, but he was wearied by the world. We live in a very wicked society, and I would have to say that the world we live in today probably resembles the land of Canaan and the land of Ur more than we would even like to admit. The land of Canaan was very wicked. Leviticus later will read the sins of the land and the sexual sins of the land that are laid out in the book of Leviticus when God led Israel into Canaan. And God said to Israel, stay away from the wickedness of the land. And he gives them some of the lists of the sexual sins of the land. And it describes, sad to say, some of the very sexual sins that are acceptable right here in America. And God brought judgment on Canaan, and he brought judgment through Israel, but he warned Israel of the dangers of the sins of the land, and there would be curses upon them if they disobeyed God, if they became idolatrous and immoral. And here's Lot in those early days of Canaan. Before Leviticus was ever written, before the Mosaic Law was ever put on the books, on the stones, and given to Israel, here's Lot, and he's affected by the world. Even as close as he was to Abraham, he was affected by the sins of the land. And he is a warning to us. And tonight, as we begin this message, as we've set a little bit of a background, historical background, I want us to define what the world is. Let's begin with just an introduction defining the world. Well, 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17 define very clearly what the world is. You don't have to turn there. We know the passage well. But 1 John 2, 15 through 17 defines the world as the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. So we see that there is this lust of the flesh that defines the world. And the unsaved are the citizens of the world. But that doesn't mean that we as Christians are not affected by the world, because we have the sinful flesh and we live in the world, but we're not to be of the world. We're not to be conformed to the world. We're not to be a friend of the world, as Pastor Blake just read in James 4. But it's obvious that the lust of the flesh plagues even believers, even born-again Christians. But that's the world, the lust of the flesh, this desire for sinful, selfish pleasure. And that's what we live in today around us. There is almost an insatiable thirst for pleasure at almost all costs. Fun, is the number one priority. I tell the kids at school sometimes, I say, God has not called us, has not guaranteed us, the Constitution doesn't have as its first right, thou shalt have the top five entertainment choices that you want every day. But I hate to say it, but sometimes it's not just kids, it's adults that feel like they are owed their five top entertainment choices every day. And we could maybe describe them in various ways. And often they involve the internet or the media, the mass media or entertainment media. But we have to be careful, so careful, because the world is full of lust, selfish, sinful lust, and we can very easily get trapped in those same patterns. The lust of the eyes, this desire, this idolatrous desire for stuff, possessions, having it, getting it, and never being happy with it because somebody else might have more. Somebody else might have better. Somebody else might have gotten it first. And we see it all the time, from name brands to styles to trends to cars, on it can go. And we see Christians that are often caught up in the possessions of this temporal world. Again, we are not here, I'm not here, I should say, to say it's wrong, obviously, to have a nice car or a nice house, to make a good salary. Of course, there are ways in which God provides for us and enables us to be able to put food on the table, clothes on our backs, and to have a decent lifestyle. But sad to say, too often, it has become the idolatrous desire of even believers to just have more. And somebody else got ahead of me. Somebody else got something I didn't have. And we have advertisements everywhere. Don't the advertisements get on your nerves when you're trying to click on just read an article in the news or someone's blog or something, and you're just trying to click on the article, and then there's that stupid pop-up, right? And just as you're trying to click on that article, that pop-up, you hit that article instead, and you're just like, I don't want that. But it's just like there's this constant bombardment of advertisements you've got to have. You won't be happy unless you get this. The voices are so just all around us, and they're so loud. You've got to have this stuff. I mean, Saturday morning cartoons, as they used to be. Now it's the Saturday morning internet. I don't know, all right? But what do the kids get? I mean, you can turn on Nickelodeon or whatever the kids' channels are, Boomerang or whatever, and what are the advertisements? It's just toy after toy after toy after toy after toy. And a room is full of toys. You're putting them in the garage in boxes because you don't have any more room for toys. But what's the child saying? I just got to have it, Mom, Dad, I just got to have that, right? And then you see the parents agonizing around Christmas or around their kid's birthday, and they're in the toy aisle, and I don't know what to get, you know? And they have everything, and there's so many options. And it's just that stuff, gotta have it. So the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and there's the pride of life. This is the thirst, the desire for power, control, manipulation, domination. And we are so sometimes worldly minded that we love to dominate our little clique. There are some people, they just have to have a group of people that they can just control. And I deal with kids at school a lot, and sometimes it's a group of girls, and there's one girl that just kind of tells every other girl what to do. And the rest of the girls, they just have to, like, feed out of her hands. Because if they don't do what she says and wear what she wears and go where she goes and watch what she watches, then she's going to tell on them. And she's going to say some nasty things about them. And then they're going to have a group of girls who all say, well, you don't have, and you're not this. Believe me, I've dealt with it. And then there's the alpha males. And then you got those boys. And you got the other boy that comes in, and now they're going to duke it out for who's going to be the alpha male. Who's going to have the prettiest girlfriend? Who's going to be able to tell all the other boys what to do? Who's going to have whatever control he can have over those young men? It's amazing. My wife and I have worked with kids for a long time, and it's amazing in a small group of kids, there can be one boy, and the rest of them are girls. And then all of a sudden, a boy, this is a young group of kids, okay? Their mom and dad didn't sit them down with a manual and say, next time the boy comes into the group, you are going to have to fight for your territory. No, it's just in us as boys. We got to have our territory. And that boy will have another boy come join the group. And this is just a group of young kids. And all of a sudden, there's jealousy. There's fights. There's just back and forth. And my wife and I look at each other and say, yep, that boy came in, and now he is fighting for his territory. I've seen it all the way up through ages. And then they become adults. And then they get really mean and nasty. And they dominate. And they dominate their wives. And they dominate their children. And they let everybody know in their household that they are in charge. And they are the authority. And we have to be very careful as men, because we'll get so thirsty for our pride and our power and our ego trips that we will dominate and be rude and just downright angry in our attitude and our spirit and domineering in the way we run our homes and the way we deal with people. And it's nothing but pride. It's the way the world says you're to live, you're to lead. You lead by power, you lead by domination, you lead by putting down that iron fist and making everybody pay for disagreeing with you. And that's part of worldliness. There are ladies who manipulate constantly their husbands and their kids against their husbands, and back and forth it goes, and the man's trying to dominate the wife, and she's trying to manipulate and control, and the homes are a mess. It's worldliness. It comes out in an attitude that results in actions. And we're going to get to, in the next slide, what Jerry Bridges defines in his book, Respectable Sins. So I had to go to these because they're just so good. And eventually we'll study these very, very carefully, Lord willing, in our adult Bible study classes. But Jerry Bridges, in his book, Respectable Sins, he defines worldliness as being attached to, engrossed in, or preoccupied with the things of this temporal life. Maybe we should do a checklist. How engrossed am I? How preoccupied am I with the things of this life? What about the next definition that Jerry Bridges gives? He goes in the next paragraph or two and he defines it again, and he really makes it hurt. As I was reading through this chapter a little while back, It's just very clearly stated here, accepting the values, the mores, and practices of the nice but unbelieving society around us without discerning whether or not those values, mores, and practices are biblical. Some people define it as moralism. Just be kind. Based on what standard? Based on what value system? Based on what power or strength to be kind? I don't see much kindness when I get on the news on either way in multiple different angles. There's very little kindness that goes on. I hear young people, again, I'm not here to just be critical of all the TV shows and stuff that are out there. That's not my point, but I see some of these TV shows for young people. In most of the episode, the young people are mocking the other young people. And it is just so funny. The sarcasm and the put-downs and the mocking and the making fun of. And they especially make the adults look like doofuses. And so you've got these kids who they just spend, I don't know, hours sometimes just watching the interactions, and it's just almost entirely made up of letting the other person know how dumb they are and putting them down and ridiculing and mocking them. And then I come to school and I wonder why the kids cannot say hardly anything kind to each other. Someone makes a little mistake, trips over something in the hallway, and it's like mocking. You know, boys throwing food at the lunch table and getting stuck in a girl's hair. And then the girl walks down the hallway with food in her hair and all the boys are laughing at her. I mean, how is that kindness? How is that respect for that young lady? And you say, well, that's not, and then Jerry Bridges makes a great point in his book, Respectable Sins. He says, you know what? We'll say, well, I'm not as bad as the rapist and the murderer and the harasser that's been getting thrown in jail, but we are guilty in our worldliness of having the same kind of attitude that results in, oh, maybe not as gross of a sin. It's not in that top 10. It's not as bad as, but it sure is worldly in its roots, in its outward display, though it may not fall into that top 10. So therefore, it's okay. It's not that bad. But Jerry Bridges nails it. He says, accepting the values, mores, and practices of the nice but unbelieving society around us without discerning whether or not those values, mores, and practices are biblical. Those definitions hurt, don't they? They get right down to the nitty-gritty of where we're at and the way we think, because worldliness is as much an attitude or a mindset as it is an action or an outward display. And when Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount, what did he start with? He started with the attitudes, the Beatitudes. There's a lot of fixing that needs to probably go on within that is thinking worldly that comes out in the outward actions and manifestations of it. So with that in mind, what can we learn from the life of Lot? What can we learn from the life of Lot, a worldly Christian? He was weak and he became wearied by the world. Four quick lessons from the life of Lot tonight. First of all, a worldly Christian distances himself from the godly. The worldly Christian distances himself from the godly. Genesis chapter 13. Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him into the south. They had come out. Abraham had lied to the Pharaoh there about Sarah being his wife. And the Pharaoh sent Abram on his way, and he went back to Canaan. And Lot, remember, was with him this whole time. You see it there again in verse 1 of chapter 13. Verse 2, and Abram was very rich in cattle, silver, and gold. And he went on his journeys from the south even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Hai, unto the place of the altar which he had made there at the first. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. Now, I'm going to have, if the men in the back don't mind putting that map up, I know I kind of skipped over it, but if we can come back again to that, and let's look for a minute at where Lot came out of. Lot came out of Ur of the Chaldees on the south there. He goes all the way up to Haran up in the north with Abraham, and Terah dies there, and then they come down, and they come all the way over to Bethel and Ai, right there between Bethel and Ai in the land of Canaan. And now they have left Egypt, and they have come back to Bethel, where he was at the beginning. Okay, so that's where we're at. And notice here, getting back to our passage, unto the place of the altar, verse 4, which he had made there at the first, and there Abram called on the name of the Lord. You think Lot was watching that? You think Lot saw Abraham coming back to Bethel and getting his heart right with God after lying about his wife, after getting influenced by the Egyptians, leaving Canaan where he never should have left in the first place? Lot's watching this, and then notice in verse 5, and Lot also, which went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. Do we see, and Lot also built an altar? And no, we don't see that, do we? But I'm sure he watched Abram worship. Verse 6, and the Lot, excuse me, and the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together, for their substance was great, so that they could not dwell together. And there was a strife between the herdmen of Abram's cattle and the herdmen of Lot's cattle. And the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelled then in the land. And Abram said unto Lot, let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdmen and unto thy herdmen, for we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? They look out across the land, and Abraham sees the conflict between the herdsmen, and he wants to have some peace, and he thinks that the best way is to divide up, and you take part of the land, and I'll take part of the land. And notice what Abraham does in his unselfish spirit. He gives Lot the first choice. Verse 9, separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right, or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. Verse 10 of chapter 13, and Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. Then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves the one from the other. Verse 12, Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent toward Sodom. Verse 13, very important. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. You think Lot knew that? I think Lot knew that. And I think by the inspiration of God, we see verse 12 at the end, pitched his tent toward Sodom, in the very next verse describing the wickedness, because God is making a point to us. That Lot pitching his tent toward Sodom was with a goal and a purpose in mind. He was distancing himself from a godly man. He was distancing himself from the man who he could look up to, who would lead him in the ways of righteousness, whose heart was after God. Instead, he chose to look at the world with longing eyes. Boy, there's something there that, boy, it just looks like so much fun. The partying, and the dancing, and the music. And I got to sit here with Abraham. We got to go from place to place. We got to take care of these flocks, and we got to build these altars. And Abraham's constantly going out there and praying to God. And he's got this covenant thing he keeps talking about. And he just seems to really just want to trust the Lord. That's such a boring life. Boy, Sodom and Gomorrah, the plains, they have the life. They've got it made. They're going to just get it all. And I'm going to sit here with this boring Abraham. What a waste of my life. I can just hear it all. And we have people today distancing themselves from the godly, distancing themselves from God's word, from God's will, distancing themselves from God's leadership in their life because they want what the world has to offer, the slop of the world. Because they think the Christian life is just so boring and such a waste of time. It's so mundane. It's so just, I know I gave my life to Jesus. I know that I got saved, but this is just not much fun anymore. And we can be just like Lot and become wearied by the world and become distant from the godly leadership that God has put in our life, from his word to the pastor, to the godly parents, to the godly grandparents, to the godly aunt or uncle, to the godly counselor that's in your life saying, don't do that. Follow God, obey his word. And we have our eyes fixed on Sodom and our tent is pitched towards Sodom. How often do we distance ourselves from those who would help us grow spiritually and join ourselves to those who are spiritually harmful? You know, we will join ourselves to them by engaging in their same or very similar forms of behavior and entertainment. Oh, we may not go all the way and engage in immorality, but we'll listen to its lyrics, we'll move to its sounds, and we'll covet its empty pleasures. Oh, we won't do the actual act of immorality. We won't actually steal. We won't actually embezzle. We won't actually do that top 10 sin. But boy, in our hearts, I just hate my wife. I just hate my husband. He's such a, that church member, I'm glad we have to social distance because I don't want to be in the same room with them anyway because I can't stand them. The sight of them makes me sick. Oh, we would never murder them. Oh, no, we would never, never hate on them in some, you know, physical way. But boy, the attitude is there. The bitterness is there. The anger is there. And we've pitched our tent towards Sodom. We've separated ourselves from the godly and we've put ourselves close to the angry and the sinful, selfish, and the sensual, and the immoral. Lot's finding himself wearied by the world, but sad to say, it doesn't stop there. Genesis 14, verse 12, and they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom. There was a war among the city-states in Canaan, and they get on a couple of alliances together, and they're fighting each other, and one of the armies in one of the battles, Lot is picked up from Sodom, and he's taken, and Abraham finds out, and he comes and he rescues him, and we find here that now Lot is actually dwelling in the city of Sodom. You think that would have been a wake-up call, right? He just got taken with all of his stuff by these wicked Canaanite kings. You would think that it would be a wake-up call, that maybe God was getting Lot's attention. How many times does God try to get our attention? That crisis in our lives because of our sinful choices, maybe God is trying to say, hey, you know what? Maybe you need to get out of that place. You need to turn your life back to the Lord. Maybe you need to get obedient once again get right with God and become obedient once again. Unfortunately, it didn't wake Lot up. He found himself a prisoner of war. He was rescued by Abraham, but Lot continued to dwell in Sodom. And that leads us to our second lesson. A worldly Christian will compromise on issues of morality. A worldly Christian will compromise on issues of morality. Genesis chapter 19, verse number 1, and there came two angels to Sodom and Eve, and Lot sat in the gate of Sodom. Now he's in a place of leadership. How did he get there? I can't say with emphatic, dogmatic knowledge of how he got in that place of leadership, but by the results of the mocking of his sons-in-law, the mocking of the people as they're banging at his door, wanting to have sexual relations with the men, the two angels in his home, by the fact that his wife turned her back and became a pillar of salt, by the fact that his daughters would perform incest on him, I would venture to guess that Lot had compromised in his morality as he got higher and higher and higher in the levels of leadership in Sodom. And I'm not saying every Christian that's in a high place of leadership is a compromiser. It's not my point. My point is, Lot was probably compromising along the way. If Sodom was already exceedingly wicked before he even pitched his tent there, you can only imagine that Lot was making little compromises all along the way. And they were just building and building and building and building. Genesis 19 and verse number 8. This just breaks my heart. Behold, now I have two daughters which have not known man. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you, and do ye to them as is good in your eyes. Only unto these men do nothing, for therefore came they under the shadow of my roof. The two angels come to warn Lot of God's judgment. The homosexuals come pounding on the door, wanting, and it says very clearly, they came because they wanted to know them. Okay? And that is very clearly a reference to a physical relationship, a homosexual relationship with them. Lot knew, think about it, Lot said, don't, they wanted to stay out in the outer courts. And Lot said, no, that would not be a good idea. Stay in my house. Why would Lot say that? He knew the wickedness of the city. He knew what was happening. Those two angels, those immoral people, were hot on their trail. They were so lustful that they saw those two men as visitors. They saw them as another opportunity for conquest. It was deviant. And Lot turns around and he offers his two daughters to them. Unbelievable. I cannot imagine. I only have one daughter. There is no way on God's green earth that I would offer up my daughter to a bunch of flaming homosexual men beating at my door. Does that not tell you what Lot had compromised in his own life, in his own attitude? that he was willing to take his two virgin daughters and send them out to those rabid homosexual men to do who knows what despicable evil to them. Unbelievable. How did he get there? He compromised on issues of morality. Why is the church compromising on issues of morality? Because they left the doctrines of God years ago, because they compromised along the way in little areas of morality, till eventually the sins, the perversions of the land are so abundant that now the church is saying, wait a minute, we didn't want it to get this far. We didn't want it to get this bad. We said back then that it was just a little compromise and it would stop. And we do it in our personal lives. Little compromise. That scene, oh, it's just a few more scenes. Oh, it's just partial. Now it's full. Oh, now it's that far. Oh, just that little bit. And then it just keeps going and going. And now we are in our attitude, in our mindset, thinking just like the world on issues that God clearly defines as sin. We all have to be careful, because the world is trying to weary us for our beliefs. His sons-in-law in Genesis 19 and verse 14, they laughed at him, they mocked him. They saw him in verse 14 when he said, hey, let's get out of here. The angels have come, let's get out of here. And he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law. Why would we listen to you? What does that tell you? What does that tell you about Lot's compromise? His own sons-in-law are like, I'm not going to listen to you. The men outside pounding on the wall, they're like, who do you think you are, judging us? Now I realize that Christians who take a stand for what is right get called intolerant, discriminatory, and get called judgmental. Even Christians who stand up for what is right get called that. But the spirit, and you can tell without getting too much into the passage, you can tell that the men are saying, who are you to judge? In the sense of, you have not done right, you have not had a strong value system, you have not stood up, and now you're telling us that we shouldn't be doing this? And when you look at Lot's daughters and his sons-in-law, it's pretty clear that he was compromising along the way. So when he said, don't do this wickedness, they just looked at him and said, what? Who are you to judge us? A third lesson we can learn from Lot's life: a worldly Christian does not lead his family to fear God's judgment. A worldly Christian does not lead his family to fear God's judgment. Genesis 19 and verse 14, and Lot went out and spake unto his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. But he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law. Coming judgment? Yeah, right, Lot. You haven't lived in any way, shape, or form like there's some sort of accountability or judgment. Why should we listen to you now? His own sons-in-law, who were married to his daughters, they're wondering, who are you to come along now and say that there's a judgment? Nothing about Lot's life made them think that, yeah, this man feared God, and he knew that there was accountability and judgment day was coming. Nothing about his life caused them to be even the least bit serious, or to think that he was the least bit serious. How sad. Verse 16, he lingered, and while he lingered, judgment is coming, Lot. The next morning, he lingers. The men have to grab him, hold his hand, and upon the hand of his wife and the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him. Apparently, he had two other daughters who were not married. The Lord being merciful unto him, and they brought him forth and set him without the city. He's lingering as the judgment is about to take place. And how many Christians are lingering as the judgment of God is coming? There is a judgment seat of Christ. We will be judged according to our works. And we're lingering. We're lollygagging. I know that's an old word. Did you ever get called that? Did you ever get, growing up? Kids today out here, there's some here, maybe online. Does your mom or dad ever say, quit lollygagging, right? I know I got called that. Don't lollygag, right? That means don't be slow. Pick up your feet. Let's get going. Let's move. And those two angels are saying, Lot, quit lollygagging. Quit dawdling. Let's go. Judgment is coming. And God is saying, occupy. Jesus said, occupy till I come. There's judgment coming. Get busy for the Lord. Live in the fear of God daily. We know in Proverbs, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, beginning of wisdom. But there wasn't that fear in Lot's life. Genesis 19, verse 17, his sons-in-law died with the city. Apparently, his two married daughters with their husbands died in the judgment. Understanding as best we can that those two daughters that went with him were the unmarried daughters, and the two that stayed behind were those with those sons-in-law that mocked him. Now, they die in the city. They die in the judgment. So, two daughters are now dead in the judgment. Two daughters are with him. And then his wife looks back in verse 26. They were told not to look back, and she looks back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. And we're told in Luke 17 that we're to remember Lot's wife. The world has wearied Lot to the point that his family doesn't even fear God's judgment. His family doesn't even fear God. He feared man's dislike of his values, so he rose to a place of prominence in the city. Yet there was no respect for his moral values when his family, when he tried to finally stand up for them, because he had compromised them along the way. He finally feared the judgment of God, but it was too late. Send me to Zoar. Send me to that little city, and don't bring God's judgment there, he says as he's leaving Sodom and Gomorrah. He feared the judgment of God when it was too late. He asked for God's mercy and then had to live in a state of guilt, and eventually his daughters would commit incest against him. How many Christians today, how many of us as Christians live as if God will not hold us accountable for our actions? When the Bible says we will be judged according to our works, as a believer, we're not judged for our sin. That penalty has been paid by Christ at the cross. But we will be judged according to our works. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. And we will receive rewards. Or our wood, hay, and stubble will be burned up. Will we have gold, silver, precious stones? We have been created in Christ Jesus unto good works, which God hath before ordained that we should walk in them. But do we live in the light of God's coming judgment? Do we live lives accountable to God? Do we live in the fear of God? How about with our parenting? How about in the way we raise our children? Do we raise our children in such a way that there's no negative consequences? That would just make them unhappy, and I can't stand for them to be unhappy. I can't stand for them. They may not like me. They don't learn that there's negative consequences for sin. Are we constantly attacking the authority that dares to correct our child? How dare they? My child would never talk back to me. My child would never do that. And our child grows up, yeah, that's right, I got mom and dad fighting for me everywhere I go, everything I do. When will they ever learn responsibility? When will they ever learn accountability? You know, we have the lawnmower parents and we have the bulldozer parents. It's no longer the helicopter and the hovercraft parents. Now you got the bulldozers that are just bulldozing all the problems out of their child's life. Anybody who dares to correct their child, I've heard it so many times in school, even if their child is dead wrong, well, somebody else did it or somebody else got away with it or they started it, so my child must not be that bad. Well, your child did it this time. It's very clear. And I realize that the teacher may not have caught the other kid, but your child has done it five times, got away with it four, and finally got caught. So they need to take responsibility for their actions. And I don't care if they didn't start it. They still retaliated, and they did it worse. Sorry, I get carried away sometimes. But I hear the excuses that are made. And I wonder, the kids, no wonder they grow up. There's no accountability. There's no responsibility. There's just no fear of God. Why should they ever get saved? They've never done anything wrong. Why should they ever need God? Because they've got mom and dad to fight their battles for them, to bulldoze everything out of the way. And that authority can't possibly be right. They just don't know my child. It's unbelievable. I can only imagine what his home was like as his daughters were growing up. That they would choose husbands that would become his sons-in-law. What kind of a home life did Lot have? He was lingering at the judgment as the fire was about to rain down. Do you think Lot had really made much about God with his children growing up? How would they ever commit incest with him? They had already a value system that had been corrupted by the sins of Sodom, by a father and a mother who apparently did not fear God. As a matter of fact, Lot's wife was still so in love with Sodom, she had to turn around and see with longing eyes, and she was turned into a pillar of salt. But you know, as we close number four, the final lesson that we can learn, I know there's many more, but for tonight, the worldly Christian still experiences God's mercy. You know what? That's the wonderful thing about our God, that the goodness of God leads us to repentance. I know that is a first application to those who need to be saved, need to be born again. But isn't it so good to know that our God is rich in mercy and we can come back to him? Have you had those moments in your life? I know I have. Where God just really just hit me upside the head with a 2x4 and said, "You stubborn Brent, are you going to keep going this way or are you going to get yourself right?" And I had to get on my knees or I had to sit there and repent. And God is that kind of a God. He rescues Lot. He rescues two of his daughters. I know they commit incest with him, but there was still a measure of God's mercy that righteous Lot was saved out of Sodom. We see the mercy of God. God is faithful and just to forgive us. Maybe you've already started down the wrong road. Maybe you have messed up and you think you're beyond repair. Well, God loves to fix the broken. He loves to mend. He loves to restore. Our God forgives no matter what the sin might be. And if he would rescue Lot out of that predicament that he was in, then God can rescue you. Don't give up on God. God's not going to give up on you. You are his child. If you are a Christian and you may have afflicted your soul, vexed your soul, tormented your soul like Lot has for many years, but God can rescue you from that sin, can rescue you from that bondage. There might be scars, there might be some baggage, but there can be peace with God. There can be the joy of the Lord, and God can restore broken relationships, and God can bring you into a place of close fellowship and make you useful in his service in incredible ways. We have to fall at the mercy of God. We have to come in repentance, and maybe we can experience, like Joel cried out in Joel 2 and verse 25, that God can restore what the locust has eaten. And maybe the locusts of sin have gotten a hold of your life. And you may feel like Lot, you are wearied by the world, you've been weak as a Christian. But tonight, you can get right with the Lord. And you can experience God's forgiveness. And maybe you're sitting here tonight or you're watching on live stream and you need to be born again. The guilt of your sin is heavy on your heart. You can cry out in mercy and plead for God's forgiveness and be gloriously saved. And if you're wandering from the Lord, he will bring you back if you'll just turn to him and look to him once again. And God can restore what the locust has eaten. May that be true for our lives as we close in prayer tonight. Lord, these lessons from Lot, they're hard lessons. They're tough. They're difficult pills.